Let's go ahead and officially start the meeting. One thing I didn't say is my name is Janice Bellucci. I am Executive Director of the Alliance, and I'm also an attorney. So, unlike Jeff, I'm not a criminal defense attorney. If somebody gets charged with an offense, I am not the person to talk to, but I can refer you to an attorney who can help you. I help people who are out of custody. So, you've already been charged, convicted in custody and released. That's when I start helping people. I mean, we all have to decide, we lawyers, we have to decide these days, what our emphasis is going to be, and that's mine. I just find it too difficult and quite frankly depressing to go into prisons. I've gone into a few. I've also been harassed. Hear that. I'm an attorney and I've been harassed going to prisons. I've been they thought it was really funny one time to stick me in this, between two locked gates and or at least two locked doors and let me just stand there for a while. With no cell phone or any other way to communicate to the outside world. So, I just prefer to avoid those kind of experiences. And so I'm not going to prisons. I don't even talk to people who are in custody. Quite frankly, it's just too hard for me to do that. There's a wonderful attorney here in California who does do that. Her name is Susan Jordan. And if you know somebody who's in custody and needs an attorney, I highly recommend her. And she's worked with many people on the registry. Okay. So, thank you. Oh, there's Marty there. Thank you sharing your experience with us about the fire. Okay, so let's go on. We're going to talk about a number of issues today. But before we do that, I want to give, I guess, for lack of a better term, two commercials. One, I hope that you know that I am participating in two events in Washington, D.C. in March, very early March. Would I prefer to go to Washington, D.C. some other time of the year? The answer is yes. I've lived in Washington, D.C. for 9 years in the past, and I know early March can be unpleasant or pleasant depending on the day. But the reason that we go in early March is because it's the anniversary, or at least near the anniversary, of a really terrible decision that the Supreme Court issued. The decision's called Smith versus Doe. You couldn't think of a more boring title for a case, but that's what it is, Smith versus Doe. Okay, and the terrible decision was the U.S. Supreme Court deciding that the requirement to register is not punishment. And I mean, every time I say that, it just runs a chill down my spine. And I'm like, what the heck are those folks thinking? And in fact, the attorney representing the state of Alaska in that case, John Roberts, who, by the way, is now the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, during oral argument in the case, he said that the requirement to register is similar to membership in Price Club. So think about that. Membership in Price Club, guess what? You can cancel your membership at any time. So try being on the registry and canceling your membership on the registry. It's a lot harder to do. And many times it's impossible to do. So that's utter nonsense. And then all the harm that has been caused as a result of that decision, and without sounding like I'm a law professor, which I'm not, part of the decision too was saying basically giving a blank check to governments at every level. We're talking about city government, county government, state government, and yeah, the federal government too, that you can pass new laws and apply them retroactively to somebody. So somebody who's already been convicted of a sex offense, and you're going to tell them all of a sudden that, well, this is that we're going to do these things and those things and the other thing to you, which didn't exist at the time you did the act. And I don't know about you, Jeff, but it just makes me crazy because I always thought that criminal law was based upon at least a notion that a person thinks about the penalty they might be facing before they commit a crime, right? So how can you think of that if they're going to change the rules on you after you've done whatever conduct it is? Do you want to add to that, Jeff?
Well, there's few things that are more manipulatable than the ambiguity of the law. And the way that politics seems to work is that there's a nose count about how politically powerful a constituency is, and the weakest constituencies get the worst treatment. So when the registry was in the formation stages through the 1930s and 1940s, the LA legislative ensemble that was starting that process really counted who might be in opposition, because that dictated how much impact they could have in Sacramento. And although they started with a broad swath, the registry was originally conceived of as everybody who's been convicted, it became clear that they needed to reduce that population, and they ended up with people who had these qualities of offenses as the least politically powerful. And that was the law that got passed in 1947. It continues to be the circumstance that political power equates equates with positive outcomes. And that's why getting to the relief that came with SB 384 in 2017 was really a byproduct of developing a strategy for politically coping with how to get through the legislature. And fortunately, was successful. That's why this new law creates tiers and escape hatches that didn't really exist up until that point.
For about 70 years. So, and we'll be talking about the tiered registry later. But getting back to the U.S. Supreme Court decision of Smith versus Doe, we go there to the D.C. Area, and actually we'll be as close to the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court as they allow us. They do put metal barriers up there, by the way, so we don't actually get on the step, but we're on the sidewalk right in front of the step. So come join us if you can. The date for the vigil is Monday, March 3rd, and we will be there. We have at least 30 people who have signed up to go. And there's a conference, or I never call it a seminar. It's a one-day conference. Let's just call it a one-day conference the day before the vigil in Virginia at a hotel. And so I want you to know that Virginia, let's see, a registrant can visit Virginia for up to 30 days without registering. Okay. So you don't have to worry about that. We're only talking about 2 days. We're talking about Sunday, March 2nd, and we're talking about Monday, March 3rd. If you're from the area, you can drive there. If you're not like me, you have to fly in, and it's okay. It's very important to me that we do this. It's the third annual vigil, by the way, and I have participated in all three of them. Well, I've participated in the two past ones. I'll participate in this third one, and I think it's really important to let, of all people, Chief Justice Roberts know that he made a big mistake, and now it's time for him to clean it up. I mean, think about it. He's Chief Justice, right? As Chief Justice, he can organize the associate justices and get them focused on something. And so anyway, we'll see. Eventually, I do truly believe that we will be able to overturn Smith versus Doe. So I'm not going to belabor that point anymore. But if you're interested in going to either one of those, we have scholarships available. And just let us know that you need a scholarship. And then in addition to that, in March is going to be a busy month. On March 25th, we're going to have our lobby day here in Sacramento. So this is our, I don't know how many annual lobby days. We've been doing it every year, including it took us 6.5 years to get the legislature to agree in California to adopt the tiered registry law. And then, and now that was in 2017, as Jeff said. Here it is, 2024. Actually, that's 2025 now. And quite frankly, it needs to be improved. There were a lot of political compromises made before the law was passed, and political compromises happen. I mean, I'm a former congressional staffer myself. I saw a lot of political compromises. It's one reason I'm a former congressional staffer, because some of them I just couldn't believe, and I certainly didn't agree with. So, and none of them had to do with this issue, by the way. So anyway, please give serious consideration to coming to Sacramento. You don't even have to be a Californian to join us here for Lobby Day. And the focus of Lobby Day will be, once again, the tiered registry law and improvements to the tiered registry law. We're going to have a little easier time, I think, this year, in that we have recommendations from our Sex Offender Management Board. They agree that the tiered registry law needs to be improved, and they even agreed with some of the changes that we had asked them to agree with us. So anyway, yeah, March 25th is the day. Again, you can sign up for both of these events on the Axsall website. Maybe Marty, can you type in the website address for our website? That would be great. If you don't already know it, it's kind of long, so I don't want to talk about it. Okay, somebody asked a question. Can you enlist the aid of any rich, powerful, rich celebrity persons who have been or are on the registry to spotlight the issue of registration? That's a good idea. And you know what? Nicki Minaj comes to mind. I'm just not a fan of her music, but her husband's on the registry, and she has, in fact, spoken out against the registry. So why not at least invite her? We're also inviting, by the way, Mike Tyson. That's another good idea. By the way, we're also inviting the justices to come join us. So it turns out this year, for the first time, the justice of the court will be in session
Oh, thank you.
during our vigil. Okay, so that means that at least I'll be there. Please mute yourself if you're not speaking, and if you are not I'm not sure who this person is that's showing up on my camera, and I'm concerned that I can't delete them. We have been by we have been interrupted before. So okay, Aaron Sante, and it may just be somebody who's doesn't have their camera focused yet. Okay, well anyway, those are the two events. Again, Washington D.C. on March 2nd and March 3rd, and Sacramento on March 25th. Please join us if you can. Okay, so let's talk about domestic and international travel because that is always an issue. Oh, Jeffrey Jones from Ferris Bueller's. Yeah, they. Yeah. That's another good idea, and I actually know who represented him. What attorney? Okay, some good ideas there. Oh, he was also dad from Beetlejuice. I didn't know that. That's because I've never watched the Beetlejuice movies. Okay, so let's talk about domestic and international travel. I want to talk about international travel first because there's a change that's on the horizon. I spoke at the conference about this, and I really don't have any update, I don't think, except that I know that, oh, Marty, you're friends with Jeffrey. That's excellent. Let's talk offline about that. Okay, so the overseas travel, in the past, it's been re relatively easy for somebody on the registry to go to Europe. And so there's 26, I think now they're up to 29 people, sorry, countries on that are members of a group called the Schengen. I don't know what that stands for, but I can spell it. It's Schengen nations. Okay. So the 26 Schengen nations, have allowed people on the registry to visit. I had this mental image that they look at your passport, even if it has a unique identifier on it, and they just laugh and go, oh, those crazy Americans. Right. And by the way, the four largest nations in the Schengen group are Italy, France, Germany, and Spain. So we're not just talking about teeny tiny countries that you might not want to visit. I would imagine many people want to visit, you know, Italy, Spain, France, and Germany. But then there's a lot of smaller countries as well. Things are changing though, okay, in that there's a system that's being created. And by the way, the Europeans have been talking about it for a really long time. I didn't write out the acronym this time, but it's ETIAS. And Kathy has said that she's traveled to Schengen nations multiple times in the past 5 years. And maybe Kathy, you would be willing to share some of your experiences here in the meeting today. That would be great. Yeah. So the ETIAS system is a permit system. It's not the same as a visa, but supposedly we're going to have to request a permit in order to visit even the Schengen nations in the future. And that means everybody, not just people on the registry. So we don't know when that's going to start. The latest thing that they've said is that it will become the permits will become available starting in May of this year, so May of 2025. And then they say they'll become mandatory in November of this year. So again, to get something called a permit, an ETIAS permit. And I don't know about you, but every time there's new anything added like this, you know, I get concerned because it's going to be another level of bureaucracy and, you know, a permit. Now, supposedly the cost of getting this permit is going to be is going to be relatively low, less than 10 euros. And then it's to be done online. And then somehow they add this permit to your passport electronically. That bothers me. That is a concern, shall we say. I don't know how they do that, but I'm not going to worry about that part right now. What I'm concerned about is they're basically asking about, have you ever been convicted of a serious offense? And they don't define what that means. So is that going to mean anybody ever convicted of a sex offense? Is it going to mean somebody, and then it says, well, somebody's not in the last 10 years, you know, whatever it is, or 7 years. Now I can't remember. I apologize. But anyway, times are changing. And again, May of this year, supposedly it's going to be, those permits will become available. And then in November of this year, supposedly those permits are going to become mandatory, that you would not be able to visit a country in the Schengen, well, in Europe, if you don't have a permit. So now I'm going to turn off my phone. I forgot to do that. Okay. So that's what I want to say about overseas. And Dan has his hand up. Dan, please unmute yourself. Hello, Dan. It looks like you're unmuted.
Oh.
Okay. Oh, there you are, Dan. Do you have a question or a comment, Dan? Your hand is raised. Okay, well, you can come back later if you wish. Kathy, why don't you go ahead and talk about experiences? You said you have seem to have some background information about the ETIAS system as well as some recent travel to the Shingen Nations. Are you there, Kathy?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So my son is on the registry, but he dances professionally. We traveled the world a lot. And he also is still on federal supervision. So we have to have permission to travel everywhere. So we've not had any issues. Now we've traveled to Germany, the Netherlands, Spain, Portugal, Italy, France, Austria. I think probably that's it that I can think of right off the top of my head. But oh, Belgium. So we have been to a lot of, and those are all Schengen nations. Your Schengen nations is kind of everything except for Ireland, the UK, anything that falls under them, and anything that falls under Russia or outside of the kind of Central Europe there. But we've not ever had any issues. Now, his passport is marked. The first two trips we took, his passport was not marked, because he was still using his, he still had a one that had been renewed that they did not put it in. After about three trips, they sent a letter saying that his passport was being revoked, and it needed the identifier, which we should have asked for. Well, I figure it's their job to ask for it, not ours. So we didn't ask for it when we did it, when we did the renewal the first time, and they didn't put it in. But we had to redo it. We had to pay for it again. And they did put it in. And it is right above your regular picture page if no one knows where it's put in. It goes right above the picture page and it says this person's been convicted of a sex offense against a child or whatever. Whether it's
Involving a
child.
minor. It says
Yeah,
minor.
it doesn't matter whether it's possession of pornography. It doesn't matter what it is. That's what goes into everybody's. There's never been anybody say anything about it when we've gone into the country. The last time we went to Spain, I think they asked him, what it was about. And he kind of explained it and they were like, oh, okay. And then they just asked him where he was actually going to be at in Spain. And then other than that, she handed it back to him and said, don't worry about it and went on.
Right.
But that was the first time anybody had really ever even asked about it. Other than that, no one's ever mentioned it.
Right. Okay.
But
Kathy.
because of Angel Watch, they all get notified. And that's part of the problem is because if you're traveling, Angel Watch tries to make sure they can make as much trouble for anybody as they can.
So true. So true.
So, but as far as EDIAS, the United States has a requirement for anyone coming from another country here that's called ESTA. They have to have an ESTA, which is kind of like a mini visa to come in and out of the country if they're not going to stay longer than 90 days. So the Shenzhen nation said, well, if the U.S. is going to do that to us, then we're going to do it to them. And so basically, that's why they're implementing EDIAS is because of the fact that the U.S. requires them to have ESTA to come into our country. So, and
That's
it pretty
wonderful,
much works
Kathy.
the
Just
same way.
yeah, Kathy. That's one version that I've heard. Another version I've heard is that it's going to apply to their fellow Europeans as well. So I
Well,
don't.
it does apply to anyone outside of the Schengen countries.
Okay.
So if you're in the UK, you have to have it to come in. If you're in Australia, you have to have it to come in. If you're coming from Singapore or China, anywhere, any place you're coming in. But the whole reason they implemented it was because of the US having to have ESTA. Everywhere else, all the other countries, you actually have to have a true visa to get into them anyway. So.
Okay. Well, thank you for that information, Kathy. Again, there is uncertainty out there. That's
Yep.
why I'm bringing this up.
There is. I
And
mean, we have the same question. We don't know what's going to happen when we fill it out
right.
because it impacts us a lot. So.
I bet. I bet. So, I mean, I'm happy to hear, Kathy, that you and your son have been able to travel extensively, it sounds, during this time and everything, and despite the fact that he's on the registry. You did mention something important, and I wanted to emphasize it. You said many things that were important, but one thing I wanted to emphasize is, in fact, this idea about if you have been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor And again, we're dealing with the federal definition of minor, which is under 18, and you are required to register, or you are registered in even one state in our United States. That's when the unique identifier is supposed to be added to your passport. And Kathy, you know, she described what happened to her son, which is his passport was revoked. By the way, they revoked the passport without any warning, no
yes,
warning.
So
I've had clients who are stuck in countries. Actually, most of the time when it happens, they're living overseas. They're not just visiting. So the thing is that even though the law requires, and the law being the International Megan's Law, even though the International Megan's Law requires this, quote, unique identifier, that's what the law calls it. I call it a scarlet letter myself.
That's what we call it.
Thank you. That when you apply for the passport, the big irony here is you have to ask that they put that on your passport to make sure that they put it on the passport. And just like Kathy said, your son applied for a passport and it wasn't put on there. And so you had to go back and do it again. That took, I'm sure, more trouble and time and more money. So, folks, this is part of the craziness of being on the registry. And some people say it's the gift that keeps on giving. So let me answer a few questions here. Somebody asked, is it safe to book a non-refundable flight to a Schengen nation in May or June of this year? I'd say the timing, I don't ever get non-refundable flights, but it's up to you. So if you think it's safe to get a non-refundable flight, then go for it. I don't think it's going to make any difference in May or June because, as I said, the ETIAS system is not supposed to be mandatory until November of this year. In fact, I have been recommending to people on the registry that if they're going to travel to Europe next year, in 2025, that in fact you do it before November. Okay, because we just don't know what's going to happen in October and November. Just don't know. Somebody else asked, what is or who are the Angel Watch? Angel Watch is a part of the Department of Homeland Security. I hate that name. I think that they should be called the Devils myself. But anyway, they call themselves Angel Watch, and they got the legislature to call them Angel Watch Program. And so they're the ones who are checking on people and to see if you have a unique identifier on your passport. And if you don't, then what they do is they communicate with the State Department and they recommend to the State Department. They're the ones that make the recommendation to the State Department revoke the passport. So I really despise them. I was going to say I don't care for them. It's a stronger language than that. I despise them. They don't always know what they're doing. They don't always do it accurately, and they're causing a lot of harm. I'm reading some more messages. My husband's passport was revoked without warning just before a booked cruise. Yep. It can get even worse than that. So here's a real life story of one of my clients who consulted with me prior to going to Europe. And he and his wife were going to go to Europe for 3 weeks. And they were going to celebrate their 30th wedding anniversary there with friends, by the way. And so they purchased their tickets. They went to the airport that morning and they checked their bags. They had their boarding passes. They actually got on the airplane and they were sitting in their seats before he got a tap on the shoulder by someone who was from Department of Homeland Security, I'm sure from Angel Watch, who told him that, guess what, your passport has been revoked. That was the first notice he got that he had a revoked passport. And guess what? This is also during like the tail end of COVID, and he and his wife did not get to Europe because he couldn't get a passport fast enough. They lost thousands upon thousands of dollars for the air flights, but also for all the lodging that they had prepaid for. And oh, by the way, their friends were there wondering what the heck happened to them. So that's how, it says my stamp is on the back page of my passport. They started out this unique identifier, also, you know, what I referred to as a scarlet letter. It originally was in the endorsement pages of the passport, originally, which was toward the back of the passport. I mean, I've had many passports for many decades. I didn't even know there was such a thing as endorsement pages. But, you know, once I found this out, I went back to my passport, and sure enough, it was like on page 27 or something. But you know what? As somebody said earlier, and maybe it was Kathy, those unique identifiers now are on page 1 of your passport. So what in page 1 is, it's not on the outside of your passport. You open up the passport and the first page, it used to be the first page that had any information on it was page 2. It's got your photograph, it's got your passport number, etc. Well, now page 1, so the page before that has the language that this person has been convicted of a sex offense involving a minor. there. And that is so, so wrong. It's vague language. It's ambiguous language, and it shouldn't be there in the first place. But anyway, that's what the law currently requires. Again, if both you were convicted of a sex offense involving a minor, and it could be a non-contact, non-violent offense, including possessing child pornography, that qualifies, unfortunately. And you're on at least one registry. And folks, that's why later on, when Jeff and I talk about the tiered registry law, we're going to recommend to you over and over again that you not be on anybody's registry. So, and there, unfortunately, there are states out there like Florida and New York. Those are the two big states that I'm aware of that once you register in those states, they never take you off the registry. Even though you never return to that state, even though you don't go in on an annual basis and give them updated information, they will never take you off the registry. So anyway, so I mentioned Europe. We've been talking about Europe. Let me talk about other countries as well. Don't try to go to Asia. Okay. You're not going to get into Asia. I don't know any other way to put it. We have somebody in the call today, if he wants to talk about his experience recently, he can or not. But basically you're not going to be allowed to enter. And so why spend all that money and why spend all that time to get someplace only to be turned around? And so here's another real life story about one of my clients who was in fact married to, and I believe he's still married to, a woman who is a citizen of Japan. And so they live in Long Beach, and they were going to Japan to buy a home in Japan because she really wanted to live, to have a home there near her family. And he was not allowed out of the airport in Tokyo. And he had to wait for a flight the next day. So there's happens to be a hotel that's right in the Tokyo airport. They basically kept him prisoner, and I do mean prisoner, in that hotel room. He had room service, so he didn't starve. But on the other hand, he couldn't leave the room. And guess what? His wife couldn't come into the room. So, I mean, this is the kind of nonsense, being kind, or if not being kind, just call it bullshit, because it is, that is happening to people on the registry. So please don't try to go to Asia. Africa is kind of mixed. Central America is mixed. South America is mixed. There are some countries, what I mean by that, there's some countries where people are allowed to enter and other countries that are not. We don't have a real good feel for what those countries are anymore because, unfortunately, the person who was collecting that information, who was on the registry, has been convicted of a subsequent sex offense and is now in federal prison. So we don't have anybody out there collecting that information. If you have information you'd like to share, that would be great. Okay, I have my passport with nothing on it. I got it expedited. If, in fact, you are a, quote, covered sex offender, and again, you were both convicted of an offense involving a minor and you're currently required to register, my advice to you is go get a new passport and get one that has the unique identifier on it, or your passport could be revoked at any time. And if you want, you can call me for details. Okay, somebody said, it's been my experience that if you're on the registry, you can expect a letter at any time informing you that your passport has been revoked and you must surrender your passport upon receipt of said letter. It's true. It's very true, unfortunately. Okay, can't fly or cruise to many Caribbean countries or the UK or Mexico or Philippines. Check the updated matrix on NARSOL site. Okay, I didn't know they had one. I'll go check it myself. But email a consulate for permission. We email each country before we travel. Tell you what, visas, okay? A visa? Guess what? A visa does not guarantee your entry into a country. Some people have found that out the hard way. Okay, just because the country grants you a visa does not mean that you're guaranteed entry into that country. So just heads up on that one. I have a CP conviction and I got a passport card. I'm laughing because supposedly people who are on, who are covered sex offenders can't get a passport card. And I think the reason that the State Department doesn't issue passport cards to people, again, who are covered sex offenders, is because, they can't put the words on there or that scarlet letter. So they don't issue passport cards to somebody who, unfortunately, is a covered sex offender. Okay, check out Aruba. Maybe somebody has experience there. Maybe they don't. We had a card as well, but they put it in his passport and then they didn't redo it. Yes. Again, if you're considered a covered sex offender under the International Megan's Law, which is a federal law, they will not issue you a passport card. You'll get a passport, but not a passport card. If you've been removed from the registry, is your passport marked? That is a great question. No. Okay. If you have been removed, if you are in no registries at all, then they cannot add a unique identifier to your passport. So if you have a passport with that scarlet letter on it, and then you get removed from your state registry, and you're not on anybody else's registry, then I really highly recommend you get a clean passport that doesn't have the unique identifier on it. Passport card, yes, is of limited use. It only allows travel to Mexico and Canada, which a registrant cannot enter anyway. I don't know if that's true about only Mexico and Canada. I have a passport card myself. Every once in a while, I decide to test it at the airport. But I'm usually traveling within the state of California, and it's a valid ID for that purpose, that's for sure. I also have a real ID driver's license. But anyway, it's certainly less bulky than a passport, but it does have limited use. And I'm glad somebody brought up Mexico and Canada, because in general, registrants cannot enter Mexico or Canada. That's the general rule. I feel a little bit better about Canada because Canada doesn't allow felons to come into their country. It's not just people convicted of a sex offense. And Jeff, you have your hand up, please.
Actually, some interesting news. So Canada also considers DUIs non-admissible. And I've had a number of clients who had DUIs barred from entering Canada, but were able to get admission once they had the case expunged under California's expungement law. On the Mexico front, I just went through the process with a client who has a obligation to register based on a 1964 conviction. It's a very elderly fellow and needed dental work, and he'd arranged for dental work in Mexico. And we went through quite a bit of trying to anticipate whether he could be admitted. And the strategy that ended up being successful was that people who fly into Mexico get excluded. People who walk across the border seem to get admitted. And the client took that guidance, went to a border city, had a plan, walked through the border, had absolutely no issues whatsoever, not asked, no questions, went and got his dental work, came back, readmitted to the U.S., completely problem-free. So I would say that strategies about how to get into the country might be really important if you're wanting to go to Mexico. And since you can visit San Diego or Nogales or maybe some of the Texas border cities, it appears that if you walk as opposed to fly, you're going to be successful at getting in. At least that's the experience this client reported.
Thank you, Jeff. I've heard some stories. And of course, Jeff and I are not giving you any legal advice when we share these stories with you, but we're sharing stories with you about what has happened, what people have been able to successfully do. I will say that I have also heard stories about people once they get across the border into Mexico, they take a flight anywhere in the world they want. Because the fact is, Angel Watch is watching for flights that start in the United States and that go overseas. That's what they're looking at. And so if your flight doesn't start in the United States, they're not monitoring it. Matt, you've got your hand up, sir. We can't hear you though. There you go.
Yeah. Okay. You broke up when you were talking about, you know, I mentioned my stamp was on the endorsement page.
Yes.
My question was, my passport be revoked because it's on the passport on the back page rather than the front page?
No, it's there.
It's there. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. You're lucky. I hope your passport doesn't re-expire for a long time.
Yeah. By the way, I've applied to Canada through that rehabilitation application.
Okay.
It's taken a long time, but my lawyer said that it's a good chance that I'm going to be able to get in.
And thank you for mentioning that, because I know some other people who've been able to, through a lawyer, not me, but through a different lawyer, and I can refer people to that lawyer, get them entry into Canada. And I don't know what the factors are, but anyway, I'd be happy to refer people. So I'm glad that you found the lawyer who can do that.
Just one more thing. You know, I created a video about addiction and music, and how music affect the a person with addiction. It's quite nice. I've presented several times. So anybody interested in that? I guess I'm promoting myself, plugging.
Sure. Well, I'm interested.
Well,
So what if you?
I'll send it to you.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, I believe in the healing powers of music. I truly do. Did you get those butterflies in Canada, by the way? I like butterflies too. I'm looking at your butterflies.
Oh, that's from Malaysia.
Ah, very nice. Yeah, that makes more sense in Canada. I guess they have butterflies in Canada though. All right, sorry. I digress. All right, so here we go. What about foreign passports? I can get a UK or an Irish passport. You know, that's an interesting question. I really don't have a legal response, but I can share a story. So I know a person who went to Central America, and by the way, he's a native of Central America, and he has dual passports, that country and the United States passport. And because he could speak the language and everything else, they said, yeah, sure, you want to visit the home country? Come right in. And they greeted him warmly. But I don't know. I just don't know. Somebody else agrees with me there. Yeah. And by the way, I qualify for an Italian passport, and I'm giving serious consideration myself to getting an Italian passport. Okay, somebody who identifies as owner, please unmute yourself. We can't hear you yet. There you go. You're unmuted, owner. Oh, you might need to increase the volume, though. We can't hear you. Nope, not yet. I feel like we should be playing the Jeopardy music soundtrack here. Here we go. Are you there? Nope, no, no. I see you have somebody in with you. Maybe she could help you, because I think you like have to turn on the volume for both ends of the communication. Okay, I'm going to look at some new messages while you try to figure that out. Kathy thinks I should get an Italian passport. Molto bene. It's hilarious. I've been to Italy 3 times. The first time I went when I was younger, people assumed I was Italian, and they would come up to me speaking Italian. I learned quickly how to say, I'm American. I don't speak Italian. But anyway, yeah, I'm going to keep going to Italy even though I don't speak Italian.
Janice, just as an addressing the passport revocation issue,
yes. Okay.
I represented someone on a non-sex case who had his passport revoked in Britain as a result of a felony arrest warrant that was issued and outstanding at that time. And he was a dual citizen, had in his pocket a passport from another country, and was able to fly back to the U.S. using the second passport, had no problems whatsoever.
Yeah, well, this is the good news, folks. They have to let you back in the country. If you have a U.S. passport, they have to let you back in the country. So, owner, you want to try one more time? Unfortunately not. Okay, somebody did recommend here, wait a minute, you have to turn on both the Zoom and the PC microphones. I don't know if that helps or not. If not, you can put your question or comment in the chat part, okay? Because we still can't hear you.
Okay.
Right. Oh, there you are. Is that you?
Yes. Can you hear me now?
Yes. Wonderful.
Okay. Hi, Janice. My name's Tom Buckley.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. If I wanted to go to Alaska on a cruise, you know, the ships sometimes stop in Canada on the way up there. How would that work?
Well, here's a comment. I haven't even read it yet. I'm going to read it out loud. We regularly take closed-loop cruises in the Caribbean. From Florida, L.A. coastals, which include Ensenada and other round trips from Los Angeles. No problems in round trips from L.A. No problems in Mexico or Caribbean since 2016. We would never fly to any of those locations. Here we go. But round trip to Alaska, which included Victoria and the Canada people interrogated my husband for 2 hours, then let him back on the ship.
Oh, gosh.
I'm going to say force him back on the ship. Yeah, if I were you, I'd clean that up and clear that up ahead of time before you go to Canada.
Okay.
I know there are some cruise lines. Royal Caribbean is one of them. They won't let you on a cruise ship if you're on the registry, if they find out you're on the registry. Okay.
And yeah, so, Carnival canceled my cruise.
Okay. Yeah. Here we go. First of all, most cruise lines now will not allow sex offenders aboard. I know many who have lost money because they will not allow it. I know Carnival and NCL. I don't know what that stands for, NCL. And also, I recommend
NCL's Norwegian.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy. Also, I recommend American Cruise Line, the only cruise in the U.S. I've never heard of them, but, you know, I'm not a cruise person myself. I was forced to do it once, and I won't do it again. Even though I came back alive. I'm sorry. I think I've watched the movie Titanic too many times. Okay. Well, let's move on from overseas travel, which is a complex issue, to something that's even more complex, and the more complex is domestic travel. Now, why would I say that? It's because we have 50 freaking states, and every state has their own rules. And I mean that. So some states, you know, there's kind of different categories, but in some states, they say that if you are no longer required to register in the state where you're convicted, you don't have to register there either. Okay. That's a small number of states, and I can't tell you who they are. Okay. There are other states, and California is one of them, that says we don't care if you have to register in the state where you were convicted. But if you were convicted of an offense that requires registration in this state, guess what? Then we're going to make you register in California. And then there's all kinds of variations on those two themes. So please, please, please be extremely difficult when you go visit other places. The two that come to mind always for me are Florida and Nevada. Okay, so for Florida and Nevada, it's 2 days to 48 hours. Okay, so if you overstay those welcomes, like, oh, what's the big deal? I'm just going to stay in Vegas longer. Well, good luck. You're taking a risk. It's up to you. Oh, how am I going to get caught? I'm going to drive my car there. Blah 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 blah. Well, guess what? People have flat tires. They have car accidents. They get shot walking down the strip of Las Vegas. So, I mean, that's how you can end up in trouble because, here you are. You've got a gunshot wound. You get to the hospital. The hospital looks you up and go. And before you know it, you're basically getting charged with failure to register in Nevada. I don't think you want to do that, but it's up to you. I mean, we take risk every day, right? We take risk by getting in our cars. We take risk by walking across the street. Sometimes we just take a risk staying in our own home because an airplane could land on it, right? You just don't know. But so you as an individual have to make your own decision about how much risk you're willing to take. And Jeff can't make that decision for you. I can't make that decision for you. You're the only person that can make that decision for yourself. Okay. So here's a question I hate to hear. Ring, ring. Hi, I want to travel across the United States in a camper. I'm like, oh my God, please don't do that. I'm sorry. There is a way to do it and to do it safely, but it's going to require a lot of advanced preparation on your part. Okay. So avoid states like Florida, avoid states like New York. Because once you're on the registry, you'll be there forever. And please avoid Nevada. And by the way, I've had people ask this question, so I'm going to just put it out there. Reno and Las Vegas are still in the same state. It's the state of Nevada. So no, you can't stay 47 hours in Reno and then go spend 47 hours in Las Vegas and vice versa. It's in the state of Nevada. It's not in those cities. So, and somebody says avoid Florida in all capital letters. I certainly agree. If visiting another state with a timing requirement for registering, is there any way you can be forced to register before hitting that timing requirement? Not legally. Can Bubba, the local sheriff, drag you into jail, I guess. Could either of those states find out several years later you were there because you didn't know and come after you? I wouldn't worry about that. I don't know what the statute of limitation is in these states, because there's so many of them. But I will say that, Kathy, maybe you could mute yourself unless you really have something to say. That wasn't you. If you're not talking, folks, if you don't have your hand up, please mute yourself. Because sometimes people behind you are making noises. But anyway, somebody asked this question, and I actually think this might, if you like to take trains, taking a train is a pretty low risk way of traveling across the country. So if you want to get in a train and travel across the country, I think that might actually work, because I don't think you're going to spend more than 2 days in any place. Now, the backup plan would be if that train breaks down, take a flight out of there or rent a car and get out of that state before you trigger the registration requirement. And you can call me and ask me what it is at that point in time. But the fact is, I think in general that train travel is safe for somebody on the registry. And I haven't heard of any person on the registry being kicked off a train. If you have been kicked off a train, if you've had a negative experience, let me know. I'm not a train taker. I'm not going to be on a train. But anyway, it might make sense for people on the registry to travel by train. I found out that the state may have a time limit. No, I think I already read that one. My federal conviction makes me a tier three in California where I live. The federal judge didn't impose registration. Huh. If I live in DC, would I be free of registration duties? Since they don't impose registration. Let me warn you about DC. DC doesn't require you to register if you're visiting DC. And you can visit DC as long as you want. But if you move there, you do have to register. Okay, so that's two different things. Visiting DC and moving to DC. A visit to DC, no problem. You move to DC, you have to register. Okay. And by the way, that's important too, that issue for the vigil that we're going to have on March 3rd. Hear what I just said. You can visit DC as long as you want and you don't have to register. Also, when you're in California, I mean, in Virginia, you can stay in Virginia up to 30 days without having to register. Matt, you have a question or comment?
Yeah, my sister was put into a memory unit, Alzheimer's, and I was thinking of going there and staying beyond the 3 days.
Where's there?
In Kansas. And I was thinking of putting myself on the registry, and they said that they would take me off after I leave because I wanted to stay longer period of time. What do you think of that?
I'm not sure I would trust them. I'm sorry. But you know,
Yeah, that's what I thought.
why don't you contact me during the week and let's go together through some of their laws and everything. And then there's somebody who's put together a list of the states and stuff and what states do in fact require lifetime registration. Again, I'm always picking on New York and Florida because I know those two states for sure. If you register in those states, they never take you off.
Yeah, I know that. Okay,
Okay.
thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. And somebody suggests getting that in writing. What Kansas told you. If I temporarily register in a state while traveling, then deregister when I'm leaving, will this impact the federal requirements newly adopted that California is exempt? No. And John, I know you live in California. You're gonna be fine. And we'll be talking about SORNA in just a moment or so. Okay, the SORNA litigation that's pending one more. And these registration laws are really wacky. I agree with that. They're very, very complicated, folks. And that's why, you know, Jeff and I and all attorneys who know what they're doing are going to basically, you know, recommend strongly that you think about your travel to another state very carefully. And by the way, this can even apply to somebody who's no longer required to register in California. If you, well, whatever state you were convicted in, it's just that bizarre. So anyway, please be careful. All right. So let's move on to SORNA. Somebody's asked a SORNA question. Folks, there were some really terrible regulations issued by the federal government under the SORNA. Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act. Yay, I think I got the acronym right today. Okay, SORNA. Okay. I mean, they say such ridiculous things as if you own an airplane, you have to tell them your airplane information. You know, the thing that bothers me the most, because it's just the simplest, is that it tells you in certain people that you're going to have to register more than once a year. So in the state of California, most people register once a year. If you're transient, it's different. If you're a sexually violent predator, it's different. But most people in California register once a year. Under the SORNA regulations, at least 40,000 people on the registry who've been convicted of the same offense would have to register four times a year. What? And the thing is, in California, the registration offices will not register you more than once a year. Some people have tried it. They said, oh my gosh, I'm so worried about SORNA over here, these federal regulations. You know, if I don't register four times a year, then they're going to take me to prison. And the local registration officers will say, well, too bad, so sad. We're not going to worry about it. Your problem. Okay. So the fact is that a much larger organization than ours, that organization is called the Pacific Legal Foundation, they have filed litigation and challenging the SORNA regulation. And it's a wonderful thing. They have more than 50 attorneys on staff. It just warms my heart. They have been around for more than 50 years. Not only that, but they've taken a lot of cases to the U.S. Supreme Court, at least 17 of them, and they've won 14 of the 17. So think about it. They've got the resources, they've got the talent, and they've got, you know, the financial everything to do this. And so when we Axel, we are a plaintiff in their case. There's more than one plaintiff. We have some individuals who are on the registry who were formerly on the registry who are also plaintiffs in the case. But the whole idea is to say that these SORNA regulations violate the separation of powers. So maybe if you think back to your high school government class, separation of powers, right? You've got the judicial branch, you've got the executive branch, and you have the legislative branch. And so basically what this legal argument is that all of those are being collapsed into one and giving one branch of government, the executive branch, the power of all three. You can't do it. It's supposed to be checks and balances. That's why we have three branches of government. At least that's what I learned in my government class a long time ago. And oh, by the way, in law school as well. So we're very happy that they've taken on this challenge. It's taking forever. And by the way, they decided to file it in California, and they're out in Riverside, California, the desert. Oh well, they've got a good judge, and I trust this judge. He's been fair. He's been I wish he were a little more courageous. And the reason I say that is because he issued a preliminary injunction, but it only applies to registrants, people required to register in California. So what that means is Californians who are on the registry don't have to abide by the SORNA regulation. And that's a big deal. Now, I only wish that he would expand that to include all 50 states. We'll see what happens. It's not over yet. The most recent activity in the case is that the Pacific Legal Foundation filed a motion for summary judgment, which could lead to a final decision here in the trial court, which should lead to a final decision in the trial court, right? And then the and so they did that, and now the government has to file their brief this month, and then PLF gets one more bite at the apple in February, and then there's a hearing on March 10. So March 10 is the hearing. That's the scheduled date so far, but I warn you that this judge likes to change the dates around for hearings. I sometimes think that he does that. Michael, I've unmuted you now. Okay. So I sometimes, but I'm going to mute you if you're going to finish eating breakfast there. So that he, okay. So he changes the date. So other times when there's been hearings, he changed the date like two, three times. I sometimes think it's because he doesn't really want us to be there at the hearings. And if he keeps changing the date enough, we won't make it, including me. So that's what's going on there. Because somebody did ask a SORNA question. Yes, his name is Bernal. His last name is Bernal, Bernal. Okay, Michael, you have your hand up. Now I'll unmute you, sir.
Hello.
Hi.
Quick follow-up to the train thing. I have just recently completed two transcontinental train trips from Minnesota to Washington and back. I do a lot of in-state travel by train. There is no TSA to get on trains. There is never any issue whatsoever. I've never even had to show identification to get on a train, either locally, statewide, or transcontinental. It's a great way to go from state to state to state, and just seamless. They're often late, so don't be in a hurry or expect to be on time. Train travel is terrific. Thanks. That's it.
Oh, welcome. Thank you, Michael, for sharing your experiences with us. Yeah. The fact that, they're often late and can't depend on when you're going to arrive, that's why I don't take trains. Usually I'm in a hurry because I have a court appearance. Okay. So I just noticed that Marty has put information again in the chat room there about the emotional support group meetings. Folks, there's multiple meetings every month, including the one I know that Marty participates in, which meets twice a month. So please, the meetings that we have here are Zoom meetings. Quite frankly, we're here to talk about the law and regulations. We're not here to talk about how to cope emotionally. And I know there's a lot of coping that needs to be done. Okay. So somebody reminded the PLF only takes large special POS cases. I'm not sure what that means. And not private individual cases. Okay, that's true. And by the way, they are well financed. It's funny, we had a board member who had some hesitation, shall I say, basically working with Pacific Legal Foundation because, quote, they are, uh-oh. Yeah, they're not Democrats, they're not Republicans, they're that other group. And Jeff, can you remind me?
Libertarian?
Thank you. That's the word, the L word. Libertarians. Okay, but this is the deal. Democrats don't want to help us. Republicans don't want to help us. If the Libertarians want to help us, swell. Of course, we'll work with you. And so we've been working with them now for over 2 years.
I can add a small piece about PLF
Sure.
that addresses some of the ambiguity. So the federal regulations to implement SORNA are complex and demanding, and having depth in staff and financing is critical to be able to take on a challenge. Up until PLF's discovery of an interest in this area, it was a very daunting prospect of how to address an individual client's concerns that SORNA produced. So PLF has an agenda, and the agenda includes our issues, but it also includes their issues. So in the lawsuit that was filed in Riverside in front of Judge Bernal, among the things that they prized that they have thus far been unsuccessful in is dealing not with the fairness issue. That's a due process concern. That's the one that we won on in front of Judge Bernal. The issue that they were concerned about deal with the question of whether the federal Congress can delegate to the federal executive the authority to create crimes. And what the SORNA regulations do is to say, if you don't comply in the way that the regulations require, that you can be prosecuted up to 10 years in federal prison. PLF's issue, and it goes well beyond the registry, is that they want to step on and challenge the ability of the Congress to delegate to the executive the ability to create crimes. And that's the issue that they lost on in Judge Bernal's court, but will carry them all the way to the Ninth Circuit, which is the next federal court level for an appeal. And if they're unsuccessful there, which will lead to them filing an application for review called a certiorari in the U.S. Supreme Court. So PLF is like a best friend, but not like family, kind of like a well-meaning stepbrother in this sense, and that's what they're pursuing.
Thank you, Jeff, for that explanation about PLF and even more insight into the lawsuit. I think the one thing that makes me so upset about the government's argument in this case, by the way, is their proclamation that they think that these regulations apply to anybody who's ever been convicted of a sex offense. Anybody, right? So including people who are no longer required to register in the state of conviction. So, we need to stop this nonsense, and I'm being calling it nonsense. Okay, so let's move on. We've actually gotten two positive court decisions in the past week. I mean, it's remarkable to get any, and then to get two in the same week is truly remarkable. So one of them happened in all places in Florida, and I don't know about you, but I like to kind of make fun of Florida and call it Florida, D-U-H. So they're not known to be friendly to people on the registry. In fact, they're usually hostile. But there was an appellate court decision that came out this week that basically said that, guess what? It was unconstitutional for the state of Florida to put the term sexual predator on a person's driver's license. Think about it. Sexual predator. Talk about a scarlet letter, right? Even what goes on the passport is milder language than that, but it just says sexual predator. And by the way, like in California, sexual predator is a sexually violent predator, an SVP, and it's a specific designation that can't be made until you go through a large and complicated process. But not Florida. Florida's going to call anybody on the registry a sexual predator, and they're going to put it on your driver's license. So I'm really excited and happy to hear, to read this decision. Having said that, I will tell you that the court stayed the decision because they know that their state Supreme Court's going to want to review it. So it's not that the terms have to be taken off of anybody's driver's license yet, but in fact, they're saying, okay, this is what we've decided, and we're going to basically let our state Supreme Court decide, make the final decision. So I don't know, Jeff, if you read it, but encouraging. Let's put it encouraging.
Always.
Okay. And then the second decision that I wanted to bring to people's attention was here in California. And the surprising part of this has to do with the fact that the Attorney General of California weighed in on our side. Get that. The Attorney General of California weighed in on the side of a person who is not just on the registry, but who is a sexually violent predator. And so the question is whether or not this SVP could be placed near a school. And so that's what happens when they get out of Coalinga State Hospital. That's where all our sexually violent predators are located or housed. And then, oh, by the way, they call it a hospital, but I've been there. And as far as I know, hospitals don't usually have razor wire surrounding them. So it looks much more like a prison. But oh well, I digress. The sexually violent predator basically was going to be released somewhere in the state of California. And the local communities, you might imagine, they jumped up and down and said, no, not here. We don't want him in our quote neighborhood. My understanding is the neighborhood is outside the city limits, and it's in Stanislaus County, which is a little bit, it's between LA and Sacramento for sure. And a little bit east. I'm shocked. I'm really shocked. And time after time, we see people who are considered sexually violent predators and who are basically the community is just in uproar and trying to keep them from being released. The program, by the way, at the state hospital is very demanding, and it's called the conditional release program. It's very demanding. The people who go through this program have to work really hard to qualify, basically to graduate from the program. And that takes years. And then once they qualify, then they have to be placed outside the, you know, in the community. And it's supposed to be in the county where they resided prior to being committed or designated as a sexually violent predator. Our organization has weighed in, and we're an intervener in a case, one case that has to do with somebody who's a sexually violent predator. It's been 2.5 years since he entered the conditional release program. And unfortunately, the county where he is supposed to be released, for Californians, that's Placer County, known to be very conservative, but aren't they all, when it comes to this issue, that in fact, they've stopped him from being placed for 2.5 years. So, again, I'm really trying to focus on the fact that there was a decision. We are not litigating this case. It's not our case, but I think it's a case of interest. And most important to me is the fact that the Attorney General of California basically said, yeah, this person should be able to live here. So as far as I know, that's never happened before. Okay, so let's talk about Halloween sign requirements. I hope you all remember that we were able to stop a state law in Missouri. This is my first big case outside of California. And it was an important case and a little bit daunting at the same time. I'm only able to do this because I filed the case in federal court and I was able to get a local attorney who was my sponsor. So we won the case, and the judge in the case, trial court judge, issued a permanent statewide injunction. And those are three words you don't hear very often. Federal judges are normally stingy with their injunctions of any kind, and to get a permanent and statewide injunction is quite rare. So what do you think the attorney general did? The attorney general appealed the case, of course, appealed the decision. So it's right now up on appeal. Just yesterday, I got the appellate brief from the Attorney General of Missouri. I don't think there's any new laws in there. You know, they keep just going on and on again, how these signs are not intrusive, how, you know, it's absolutely necessary to have signs on the door, even though, of course, the person's on the registry, even though, I mean, all these other things. And oh, by the way, in Missouri, the law not only requires a Halloween sign, but also says things like you can't answer the door, you have to be home between these certain hours and stuff like that. The only one part of that law we challenged was a sign requirement, because that qualifies under the First Amendment. And so the federal district court judge agreed with us that it was compelled speech, that in other words, this man did not want that damn sign on the front door of his house. And so here we are on appeal. Our reply brief is due in about 30 days. And then after that, they get one final bite at the apple. I would think that we would have a decision in this case. Oh, by the way, we're out of the state of Missouri now, and we're at the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. So far, I've thought the Eighth Court of Appeals was really smart, in part because after the judge issued the first injunction, which was a temporary restraining order, the attorney general ran to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals and asked for an emergency stay to stop the TRO. And the Eighth Circuit wrote a two-sentence decision, which I just still need to put in a frame on the wall of my office, because it was a two-sentence decision. Usually appellate courts are a lot wordier than that, trust me. So anyway, their two sentences were, number one, you want to send us a brief that's too long? Okay, we'll let you do that. Sentence number two, oh, by the way, we deny your motion. That was it. So I don't know if they're going to be that kind and that minimalist in their decision this time, but the decision is in fact in front of them. Okay, that's what's going on in Missouri. We also were able to stop a Halloween sign requirement in the state of Arkansas. It was a county just south of the state of Missouri. I think they saw what was going on there. And so after we filed the lawsuit, they begged us to settle the case with them, and we did. So, but there are other counties in Arkansas that have Halloween sign requirements, I think. But we only had a plaintiff in that one county. Does anybody have any questions here about Halloween sign requirements before we go on? I'm looking in the chat, see you here. Okay. And so, folks, if you think about what happened in Florida and you think about what happened here in Missouri, the cases are similar in that it's the same basic argument that it's a First Amendment violation because it's compelled speech. Okay. So whether or not you're told to put a sign on the front door of your home, or are your basically, you know, have this language on your driver's license that says, identifies you as a sexual predator. It's the same thing because the government's telling you that you must basically share this message with the world. So I feel really good about it. And we're going to continue. My personal objective, like his professional objective, is to get rid of all Halloween signs in the United States of America. All right. So I think we're going to switch gears here. We're going to start talking about some California laws. We're going to talk about treatment law for parolees. We're going to talk about attempted offenses and tier assignments there. And of course, we're going to be talking about the tiered registry law. I would ask anybody who's listening today, or who's here today in person, or who listens in the future, please consider making a donation to AXSAL. It's really easy to do on the website. Folks, all of our funding comes from people like you. We don't get any large grants. We've tried to get any grants whatsoever. We've applied for government grants, and basically people have said not only no, but hell no. So so please, even a $5 donation can make a difference. Thank you. Okay. Tell you what, Jeff, how would you like to talk about the tiered register?
Sure. So it's an interesting saga that we find ourselves in the midst of. And the beginning point, as I earlier was explaining, was the adoption first in the world of a registry law in 1947. As time went on, it became obvious that there was marginal success in law enforcement circles of using the registry law for the purpose that was claimed when the bill was advanced in the legislature. That purpose was to be able to create some simple, direct, easy access to likely perpetrators of new crimes. That's the whole rationale that was relied on for the registry. And as time went on, it became obvious that people that were no longer, if they ever were, a significant risk that merited separating and tracking them from the rest of the body public, that they needed an opportunity to get off the registry. But when California adopted the original law and forever, it had extremely limited means to exit from the registry. In early days, an expungement was sufficient. Then that was rescinded by the legislature. Then the means was a certificate of rehabilitation under the penal code. And then in the late 90s, that was very narrowly constrained, and a number of offenses were exited from the relief being available from a certificate of rehabilitation. And successive efforts were made to reform the law in the 90s, in the 2000s, and always they were beaten down by a constituency which consisted of law enforcement and victim groups. Sometimes it was the DAs, oftentimes it was the Police Officers Association or the victim groups. And that continued until 2017, when a bill was introduced by State Senator Scott Wiener from San Francisco to significantly and positively reform the way the registry worked. And it was moving along and looking like it was going to be finalized in the legislature in the week, as Janice likes to say, on the Friday before Labor Day in 2017. A particular chair of a significant, powerful committee in the California legislature basically killed the bill. And the killing of the bill took it out of the entire legislative process. Jerry Brown was governor at that time, and he personally intervened with that legislator and undertook a negotiation, and they did a process to revive the bill that had been killed. It got put into a separate bill, which became SB 348. And as a result, bill was revived. But to be able to do that, Brown basically negotiated with Lorena Fletcher, Sanchez Fletcher, who was the assembly member who chaired the key committee, the Appropriations Committee, and gave her veto power to kind of edit what was included and what was excluded. And she used her personal preferences and her law enforcement conduit influence to cut out a number of things from the registry. But nonetheless, the tiered registry law went into effect January 1 of 2021, effective date for being able to petition July 1 of 2021. And it provided relief for people in a wide collection of categories. One of the things that's been really surprising for me is how many people who are eligible for petitioning feel some kind of gut level uncomfortableness that there's something dangerous or detrimental or risky about filing a petition, and they have held off doing it despite the fact that they're eligible. What I can tell you, and I'm sure Janice would say, is there's absolutely no downside risk to filing a petition. The question becomes not whether it's worthwhile to file, but when a person is eligible and how to proceed. And what I think is worthwhile is that there's two basic strategies about how people can proceed. One is to just fill in the blanks on the form petition that's available online and submit it, serving it as is necessary, and to see what happens. The second is to do a more thorough, more likely to be favorably reviewed preparation, and to submit the petition loaded for that potential to obstruct the other side and to optimize and increase the likelihood of success from your point of view. The advantages of each are worth noting. For people that are difficult position for financials and can't afford an attorney, then filing a petition is better than not filing a petition. For people that file a petition and lose, the judge in the trial that hears the case will reset your next opportunity to file a petition for no sooner than 1 year and no longer than 5 years. The process of pursuing the petition is structured in a very clear way, and it has some very clear rules. So the petition process is, it must be filed in the county where you're registered. For people that have California convictions but who now reside outside California, a number of people have been convinced or concerned that they're ineligible to apply for relief. And the strict statement of the law is you have to be a California resident and a registrant in California to file in California. I have now gotten two people who were registrants in other states based on California convictions terminated from California obligation by a strategy of having them resume a registration in California. California requires people to register anywhere that they regularly reside. So if you have a vacation visit or a cousin that lives somewhere in California, particularly if it's a place where it's more favorable to petition, you can, based on that and based on returning to periodically reside with that friend, family member, or contact point, register in that county and then immediately file a petition to terminate. I've done it twice. Both times it's been successful. So for people that are in that category outside of California with California convictions, hope exists that you can pursue that. I know that this was a tough path, and in the past I filed a lawsuit with another attorney challenging the constitutional right to travel infringement that registry obligations and residency requirements imposed, and we lost. Now we win under this new law. The question of whether to go on a bare bones petition or an enriched petition is really, unfortunately, just a financial one. The way that I have chosen to do it is to file petitions with a wealth of information, and there's a reason why this is advantageous. So the way the law was created in 2017, the district attorney is the primary decision maker for reviewing petitions to determine whether someone should be terminated or not. The way the law was created, if the district attorney is convinced that the petition should be granted, they file a document that says that, and the judge has no discretion but must sign the termination order. So the judge is really not the key decision maker. The key decision maker is the district attorney, and my challenge has been to try and persuade district attorneys that they will lose if they challenge the termination, and to do that based on what the law is. The legislature created an extremely favorable criteria for our side to obtain terminations of registry. And this is the rule or the legal standard that's applied. People historically are used to district attorneys being able to trot out burden of proof. It's on the defendant or the person who's on the registry to prove that they should be terminated. The new law says that the burden of proof is on the state, and this is the way that burden of proof is stated. The court is required to terminate a person unless retaining the person on the registry significantly enhances community safety. There's a published case, People versus Tai, that makes this conclusion the law in California. Up until Tai, it was routine that what you would see when you filed a petition is the DAs would oppose it by saying how bad the original case had been, and they'd trot out the police report and the detective, and they'd call the victim, and they'd get all these statements pointing to a 25-year-old conviction as the basis for denying termination. People versus Tai said that that is insufficient and not a basis to deny a petition. And in fact, Mr. Tai, who had been in Orange County, who lost in the trial court, was reversed by the Court of Appeal and was terminated. The new standard set out by the law and enforced or ratified by People versus Tai is that the DA has to prove that retaining someone on the registry significantly enhances community safety. And for them, that is a very difficult burden to reach. My approach has been to take background material of people covering the span of their time since their registry offense that demonstrates they've been law compliant, to get historical material, typically from the California Department of Justice in the form of a live scan report, and then, if available, to hire a forensic psychologist to do a risk assessment, and to provide all of those to the DA in advance to persuade them that they should not oppose. And so far, that's been overwhelmingly successful.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. That's a really comprehensive description of our tiered registry law as it is today. There's been some questions and comments here in the chat room as well. So the following statement will probably not surprise you, which is that as attorneys, we have different approaches to this. And so my approach is actually simpler and yet successful. So what I'm talking about is I would never ask my client to go get a psychological evaluation done. Unless the DA objects to the petition. And that's because it costs money, thousands of dollars and time to get a psychological evaluation done. But that's just, you know, difference in how attorneys act here. So, I want to emphasize what Jeff just said about those two appellate court decisions. They're called Tai and Franco. It's really changed the battlefield, I guess, for lack of a better term. Before that, I was always arguing that it was, in fact, the DA's burden to prove that my client posed a current danger. And of course, they would argue against that. Those two cases, those two appellate court decisions said, yeah, guess what? It's absolutely true. The government must prove that you are a current danger. Or guess what? The judge must grant a petition. And I just had a case like that recently, and the judge was not comfortable, a female judge who I could tell was not comfortable granting a petition. But you know what? After I told her, reminded her what those appellate court decisions said, and that really it was mandatory for her to grant the petition. She did in fact grant the petition. Having said that, she made us wait an extra week for her decision, but still she came to the right decision. And I had a case similar to Franco and similar to Tai in the fact situation, and it's the only time one of my petitions has been denied by a trial court judge. And it was in Los Angeles County, and that judge really forgot that day that he was a judge. And what I mean by that is he was a former deputy district attorney who basically was arguing in giving the DA, the district attorney's argument that day. And I was very angry and upset, but my client was devastated by what that judge said that day. He said the judge said things that weren't even in the record. And I tell you what, I walked out of the courtroom that day and I said, I'm not letting this judge get away with that. And sure enough, we appealed the decision. And guess what? The appellate court agreed with me that that petition had to be granted. And again, you know, it was a petition of a man who had been registering for 30 plus years, had only one sex offense, one victim, blah, blah, blah. And the judge that day, as I said, he just forgot he was a judge that day. So when that happens, and it happens very rarely, Jeff and I are there to make sure that the judge is reminded that he or she is a judge and that they have to follow the law. So, it's been really, It's been really satisfying to help people get off the registry. I'm now up to 117 of my clients are no longer required to register. And honest to God, every time it happens, I feel like I'm freeing a slave from a plantation. So, it's funny because my original goal was to get 100 people off the registry. Well, I've blown right past that deadline or that goal. So I guess I have to say it's the new number is 200. So please, 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 if you're eligible to petition, hire Jeff, hire me, do it yourself, go to a public defender, but go ahead and get off the registry. For one thing, we don't know how long the tiered registry is going to survive. You know, and I'm an optimist, but still, you know, the legislature likes to tweak things and change things, and sometimes courts reverse things. And so, you know, I'm just out there. It's like, go, 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 get as many people through the pipeline as possible. So I said I've gotten 117 of my clients off the registry. I have filed more than 150 petitions, and the rest of those petitions are still pending right now. So, and all over the state. And so Jeff and I and, you know, California attorneys, we can file these petitions all over the state, and I do. And as I said, it's a real, not only a professional, but a personal goal of mine to get as many people off the registry as possible. I want to repeat an important thing that Jeff said. Not enough people are filing petitions, and I'm not sure why that's happening. Is there a fear factor there? Is it the ick factor? I know that some of my clients have PTSD when it comes to, to these matters, going back to a courthouse. 90% of my petitions are not objected to by a district attorney. 90%. Okay. So what that means, if the DA does not object to your petition, there's no hearing. You don't even have to go to court. Okay. I can't guarantee any specific individual that you won't go to court, but 90% again of my petitions don't go to court. And when they do, guess what? My client says nothing. And I do mean nothing. You stand by my side and I speak for you. Okay. And with that one exception of that one judge who forgot he was a judge, no judge has ever said anything negative about my clients. They know better. Okay. They're professionals as well. And they're supposed to keep their damn opinions to themselves. So even if they don't like you, even if they don't like the tiered registry law, too bad, they have to grant your petition. And I mean it. If the DA does not object to your petition, the tiered registry law requires the judge to grant your petition. And I will tell you, it felt damn sweet in that case that I took up on appeal. And guess what? The appellate court agreed with me. I went back to the same courtroom with the same judge, and I took my victory lap, and he had to sign that petition. He had to sign the court order granting the petition. That was a sweet day. I'll remember it for a long time. So anyway, somebody says you are being nice to that LA judge. He was a bad apple. I guess that's what that means. So the county DA who will be arguing against your petition, yes. Okay, so the process after the petition's filed, first law enforcement looks at your petition and makes a determination about whether or not you're eligible. And then the second part of that is the district attorney decides whether or not to object your petition. Now, I've had an interesting situation recently, and the case is still pending, where the law enforcement has determined a person eligible and the DA is disagreeing with it and has objected to the petition saying he's not eligible. Well, I think I'm going to ultimately win this case, but we're having to jump through some extra hoops because of it. And again, if the DA does not object to your petition, you've won because the court must grant your petition. That's like my clients are, well, when are we going to know? Well, it all depends on how quickly they act. So the registration office has up to 60 days to decide about your eligibility. And then the DA has an additional 60 days after that. That's what the law says. I had a case. I just went to court yesterday. No, Thursday. I went to court on a case where the law enforcement took more than 60 days. And then the DA made their decision within a week. And usually, see, the law doesn't require law enforcement to tell us what their decision is about eligibility. So we usually hear about eligibility through the DA's office. In this situation, I heard from law enforcement that he was eligible, and I'm looking at the clock and going, man, the DA's office only has about a week. We had a hearing scheduled. In fact, I did go, I made an appearance. It wasn't really a hearing, and my client didn't have to be there. And so on Thursday of last week, which was the 16th of January, sure enough, the court granted the petition because the DA chose not to object. Okay, so here's some questions about Tier 3. Jeff is answering those. If your initial case was a wobbler and charged as a felony, you can file a 17B to have the felony reduced to a misdemeanor. That is true. And well, you did say that if the case was a wobbler, it's true. Okay. But not every case is a wobbler. Not every case can be reduced from a felony to a misdemeanor, but you're right. Many times when that happens, you go from tier three, which is the highest tier that requires lifetime registration, way down to tier one, where the registration requirements is only 10 years. If person is living in another state, getting off in California isn't going to make any difference in the state that person is living in. Is that correct? And Jeff, I think I agree with you. It's state by state. California relief does not compel the other state to remove you, but it could happen. And so, just like Jeff, I've had some clients who were convicted in California and who wanted to be removed from the California registry. And this is kind of the strangeness of this, right? So if you're on the California registry and you leave the state, and by the way, you properly notify your registration officials, right, that you're moving, California automatically takes you off the registry. It's automatic, okay? So the thing is, though, if you want to get removed from the registry, you have to come back to California and establish a residence. And by the way, it doesn't have to be your only residence. It doesn't even have to be your primary residence. As you can establish a secondary residence, or tertiary for that matter. Anyway, you just establish a residence in California, then you register in California, and then you get your tier assignment. And based on that tier assignment, you can go in and petition for removal. I'm working with somebody right now, and we're going through that process as well. And by the way, you can actually be registered in multiple states at the same time. You might want to do that. So I don't know, the person who said about living in another state, it depends on the state, right? I'm sorry, I'm getting distracted by other questions. I'm going to stop looking at that for a minute. But you can, in fact, be registered in more than one state. And so my clients, I'm just trying to remember all of them, but I think they have chosen, a couple of them anyway, have chosen to remain registered in the state where they currently live, and then come into California, establish a secondary residence, and then apply for a petition in California and gotten off. I always tell people when they make that decision that I cannot tell them, I cannot give them legal advice about what the state where they currently live is going to do about it. So please, 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 you need to check with attorneys in those other states as well, because sometimes it's going to help get you relief and sometimes it's not. Somebody has asked about the amount of time it takes to get through the petitioning process. I normally tell my clients 6 months. 6 months from the time we file the petition until you get a judge's order. Sometimes it's less time, and every once in a while it's more time. I had two clients in Fresno County at the same time. Those took over a year. It made no sense what that was happening in Fresno, and I don't know how many times I drove down there. It was not a pleasant experience, but drove down to Fresno only to find out that, you know, some strange thing had happened. Let's just put it that way. Well, this is what it turned out to be the bottom line. There was a Superior Court judge in Fresno County who didn't want to grant any petition, so he just refused. And you know what? As soon as he retired, and by the way, he was eligible to retire, he wanted to retire, and they told him he couldn't retire. So he said, well, I'll fix that. I'm just not going to grant any petitions. And sure enough, as soon as he retired, the new judge started granting petitions. So sometimes it has nothing to do with you, nothing to do with the quality of your petition. It only has to do with the judge. And we just have to deal with that. Somebody asked, what if I'm on an undetermined tier? I hope nobody's on an undetermined tier at this point in time. In fact, we filed a lawsuit against California Department of Justice about 2 years ago because they had so many people who hadn't gotten their tier assignment yet. If you don't yet have your tier assignment, and you've been here for, I'd say, more than 6 months, if you don't know what your tier assignment is, the easiest way to get it, I believe, is to go to the office where you register, okay? Go to that office and ask them for something called a form 8050-8050. The name of that form, and I'll write it in the chat room, is proof of current registration. Okay, proof of current registration. This form makes me crazy, because why would you file a petition to get off the registry if you weren't currently registered? Oh, well, there I go trying to be efficient and rational. But right now, the courts are rejecting petitions that do not have the 8050 attached. So And the 8050 isn't a government-only database that your registration office has access to it. Jeff doesn't have access to it. I don't have access to it. Nobody in the private sector has access to your 8050. That's why you have to go to the registration office. And again, the name of the form is Proof of Current Registration, okay? That form on the front page or page one of it does, in fact, have tier assignment listed, okay? So it's a really important form. Usually it says tier one, tier two, tier three. Tier three comes in two different flavors, by the way. It can be tier three. If it just says tier three, that's lifetime registration. There's no exception. It could say, though, tier three dash risk level. If it says tier three dash risk level, guess what? You can petition after 20 years. It happens to be one of those exceptions to the rule. The law loves exceptions, by the way. It keeps Jeff and I busy dealing with those exceptions. We have just established a residence in California. My husband registered 2 days ago. How long will DOJ take to determine? Dear, you know what? This was the deal. And one of these situations that doesn't make complete sense to me is that in order for the office to register you, they have to decide there's an equivalent offense. If you were convicted in another state and you come to California, they have to supposedly make a decision that there's an equivalent offense before they register you here. Okay, so then how can they tell you later they don't know what your tier is, right? They had to have figured out what the equivalent offense is. But anyway, I'm being much too logical. So the fact is that, they should be able, I would say within 30 days, that DOJ should be able to determine your tier within 30 days. If they don't, call Jeff or call me. If you do register in multiple states, you will fall under SORNA. It all depends on the other states. California is not a SORNA state. By the way, 2/3 of the states in our country are not SORNA compliant. 2/3. I mean it. There's like 17 states, I believe, that are SORNA compliant. The rest of us say to the federal government, thanks, but no thanks. Okay. How long do you have to live in California before you can petition? This is great. There's no requirement. So and I say that and I laugh because the previous way to get off the registry was through a certificate of rehabilitation. And that required you to live in the state of California for 5 years continuously before you applied under the certificate of rehabilitation. Under tiered registry law, there's no such requirement. As soon as you get here, you can file a petition and you have your tier assignment. And when it comes to a federal conviction, it doesn't make any difference. Federal convictions, the California DOJ can still issue you a tier assignment, and they will. Okay, so don't worry about that, rightly or wrongly. And by the way, let's talk a little bit about one offense in particular, the possession of child pornography, which can be either federal or state conviction. That is either a tier one or a tier three offense. Or tier assignment. I'm laughing because it doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't make sense to me that this offense would ever end up on tier three. It's a non-contact, non-violent offense. Give me a break, right? How can you end up on tier three where the violent rapists are? So, but there we go for reason and rationality. As Jeff said, there are many political compromises made before the tiered registry law was passed. So this happens to be one of them. And so some people who are convicted of possessing child pornography are in fact assigned to tier one, and some are assigned to tier three. If you went through the state system and it was a felony, okay, that's tier three, unless it can be reduced to a misdemeanor, in which case you'll be on tier one. And if it's a federal law and federal conviction, I don't know what the difference is. California DOJ is not sharing that information with us. Someday that they will, or I'll just have to sue them to get it from them. Is there any hope for people on tier three, Vincent? Yes, I think there is, because we are lobbying the legislature. And remember, I said earlier in this meeting, March 25th is our lobby day. We hope everybody today, plus your loved ones, would come and join us for lobby day on March 25th. And one of the things that we are requesting, and we've requested now several times, actually every year, is to create an off-ramp for people who are assigned to tier three. Okay. Makes no sense to me that if you're on tier three, you have to remain on the registry for a lifetime. 30 years is a really long time. If you can keep, you know, can you be a law-abiding citizen for 30 years, you know, be a tax-paying citizen for 30 years, blah, blah, blah. Well, my goodness, you should get a chance, too, at getting removed from the registry.
I can add one small piece to that, Janice. So Janice led, and she and I participated in lobbying the policy entity, which is called the California Sex Offender Management Board, to make changes in the law that were part of this compromise in 2017. We proposed 7. They ended up adopting and endorsing 3. And one of them is to take possession of CP from tier 3 to tier 1. A second is to take sexual contact with a child 14 or 15, which is 288C, from tier 3 to tier 2. And a third one involving 288.2s. Those are not law at this point, but we have the incredible support and endorsement in a formal report from the California Sex Offender Management Board, which is basically probation, parole, cops, DAs, and one criminal defense attorney recommending the legislature do that. There's an additional recommendation by a state Supreme Court justice in an official advisory opinion recommending an additional change. So those shifts are possible, and it's a matter of the political will, and the lobby day is part of that effort to try and move it forward. And with Janice's leadership, I think we're making a difficult situation more hopeful.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Folks, we worked really hard, our organization, to get the original tiered registry law, and the law that we were supporting, if that had in fact passed, 90% of the people on the registry, 90%, would in fact have been eligible to petition for removal. As it is, it's about half of that. About 45-50% of the people on the registry are eligible or will be eligible at some point in time. I went to the KSOM meeting that was held last Thursday, and at that meeting, they basically shared information with those present, including myself, about how many people have gotten off the registry so far under the tiered registry law, and that's about 8,200 people. So 8,200 people have been removed from the registry as of, I think it was January 3rd, have been removed from the registry so far. And then compare this to 130 people. Only 130 petitions have been denied. And I don't know what the percentage is, but that's a really, really low percentage. So over 8,200 petitions have been granted, and only 130 of them have been denied. You know, those are damn good odds, right? And so I hope that if you know somebody who's on the registry and might be eligible, please, please, please persuade them to file a petition, because again, they're really good odds as long as you're eligible. Now, in addition to the ones that were denied, there's about 600 petitions that have been dismissed, and a petition gets dismissed when a person's not eligible. But this is a person who says, I don't care that I'm assigned to tier 3, I'm going to file my petition anyway. Okay, good luck, and guess what's going to happen? Your petition's going to be dismissed.
Janice, yes. That's about a 1.5% problem rate.
Thank you. That's what we need, a statistician. They could figure that out for us. Thank you so much. Do you have to be a California resident to file? Yes. Because actually, if you're not, then the courts don't have jurisdiction over you. What about KSOM recommendations, reduced tiers? Yeah, I agree with Jeff. It's a political question. But folks, we have to keep asking that question. We have to keep tugging on their sleeves, right? And so with the original tiered registry law, we lobbied for 6.5 years before we got a tiered registry law. Guess what? We're about at the same point now for improvements to the tiered registry law. So maybe our ship is coming in. I don't know. We don't have an author, and an author would have to be somebody who's a legislator to sponsor the bill. We don't have a sponsor. A sponsor is somebody who is not in the legislature, but who believes that this should happen. So if you have any examples for us, please, please, please let us know. But I will tell you, Jeff mentioned the author of the original tiered registry bill that passed, and that is, in fact, Scott Wiener. He was a freshman senator at the time, a freshman. That was his very first term, and he took it up for whatever reason. Bless him, bless him, bless him for doing that. And maybe there's going to be a new Scott Wiener out there, somebody who, you know, who represents a safe district where they don't have to worry about not getting reelected. And Scott Wiener Weiner himself has basically let us know he doesn't want to be known as Senator Sex Offender. So yeah, he was happy to help us get the tiered registry law passed, but he's not willing to help us get it improved upon. Okay, so I think that's all I have to say about the tiered registry law. I know a lot of questions in the chat, and Jeff is doing a great job answering them. That's great. So I'm going to move on because there's just two more issues to bring up briefly, and then we're going to wrap up the meeting. Issue number one is this. It has to do with registrants who are on parole. And by the way, we have over 7,000 people who are on parole and who are required to register. So we're talking about a large group of people. Well, we filed a lawsuit against the Department of Corrections. By the way, I love suing CDCR. I have a really high success rate with them, and they know who I am. So this time when I filed the lawsuit, they said, wait. Yeah, maybe we're doing something wrong. What will it take to correct it? And so what they did was they issued new regulations. And in their new regulations, it basically says that they cannot require every registrant on parole to undergo treatment the entire time they're on parole. That was what they were doing. It was an unofficial, unwritten policy that was in violation of state law. I just love it when the Department of Corrections is breaking state law. Oh, well, they do it sometimes, and they've gotten away with it for many years because there wasn't anybody like Axol to basically challenge them. But we're here now, and we're going to challenge them when they do ridiculous and illegal things like that. So for over 7,000 people now, they are supposed to have an annual meeting with their parole officer and their treatment provider. And during that meeting, the decision's supposed to be made whether or not they require any additional treatment. And guess what? If the decision is yes, more treatment is required, they have to put the decision in writing. And get this, they have to give you a copy of the decision. Now, the reason that is so important is because if they say something that's not reasonable, much less it's ridiculous, then guess what? Jeff or I or somebody else can take it to court, and basically we could file a habeas petition on your behalf, okay? So this is really important change, and that's only happened. Regulations were issued on October 14th. And again, you think about it, with 7,000 people, it's going to take a while for CDCR to make it through 7,000 containment meetings. So anyway, at least they have started. And then final decision I want to bring up quickly has to do with attempted offenses. So this is important because we filed a lawsuit. This one was against the Department of Justice, and this one went to trial, and the judge agreed with us that the Department of Justice should not basically put somebody assign somebody to a tier as if they had completed the offense. And, you know, I think probably the clearest example has to do with rape. Okay. So if somebody unzips somebody else's zipper and says, hey, I'm going to rape you, and the other person says no, and they go, oh, okay, and walk away, right? That could be an attempted rape offense right there, but it's not a completed rape offense, right? So come on, folks. And what was happening is DOJ was putting people even convicted of attempted rape on the highest tier, the tier three, when in fact it doesn't belong there. So if you have in fact been convicted of an attempted offense, please contact Jeff or contact me, and we will do our best to get you a new tier assignment. Some tier assignments go from 3 to 1, but more of them go from 3 to 2. But even a tier 2 assignment is better than tier 3, because if you're on tier 2, guess what? You can, in fact, petition for removal at some point in time. Okay, so that's about all I have to say today. I want to remind you again, Lobby Days on March 25th will be in Washington, D.C. on March 2nd and March 3rd. There are ways to sign up for these events, to participate in them online on our website. Jeff, any final words from you, sir?
I think the best takeaway is to realize that this is a situation that is hopeful and where the risk downside is really non-existent. The chance of being removed does not contain any adverse impact. You're not going to get singled out, more adverse treatment. You're not going to get posted on the Megan's Law website if you're not there. One of the benefits of removal is you get taken off the Megan Law website as soon as you're removed as well. So it's a high level of opportunity. Someone asked, and I'll just say it verbally as opposed to type it in the chat, trying to locate me. The easiest way is just to to go to Google in San Luis Obispo, and if you put in my name in San Luis Obispo, it'll pop up.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeff, and thank you all for being here today. For those of you who are not here in real time and listening, thank you for listening, and we will be back, in fact, in February. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.